From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In a typical year, the pro football season starts with excitement, enthusiasm, lots of interest in which players and which teams might outlast their rivals and make it to the grand stage of the Super Bowl. But for pro football, 2014 has been anything but a typical year. Just in the past week, a jury indicted Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson on a charge of felony child abuse. The NFL has just announced a new effort to prevent domestic violence by players as the league faces widespread criticism over how it's handled the incident in which Ray Rice of the Baltimore Ravens was caught on video knocking his fiancée unconscious in an elevator. And newly released court documents in the NFL settlement over concussions suggest football officials expect as many as 1 in 3 players may develop long-term cognitive problems after their play. These issues are causing some of those who love football, as well as those who don't, to ask themselves some difficult questions about the country's most popular sport. Today on The Exchange, what's going on in the NFL? Are you a fan? How do these issues affect how you see the game and the league? Call in with your thoughts and your comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us your thoughts by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have a whole panel of guests for the hour. But to start, we talk with Steve Allman. He's a writer and journalist, and his most recent book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve Allman, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
The subtitle of the book, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. You have been a diehard football fan since childhood.
Yes, guilty as charged. I have been 40 years as loving the game. I think it's the most exciting sport we have for a variety of reasons that I try to set out in the book, hopefully for people who don't necessarily understand why it is that men and women go crazy on Saturday and Sunday and spend hours in front of these football games. And the book is really my attempt to sort of reckon with the moral hazards of the game, knowing that I really love watching it.
Well, let's start with what it is that gets people so fired up about their football team or just about the sport as a whole.
Well, football combines a number of things. It hits, I think of it as like the Doritos of sports. It hits the bliss point. It's like great every time, no matter who's playing. And the reason is, I think, it combines this incredible strategic density with a really visceral connection to aggression and violence. They're big hits, and that's partly why we see the replays over and over again, and we have those parabolic mics that play us every bone-crunching decibel. It's really satisfying both primal aggression and also the strategic density. And at the same time, it really connects people to the intuitive pleasures of childhood, just the body at play. And we love to see greatness. We love to see running and leaping and jumping, but it's such an extreme level that these guys are essentially creating miracles with their bodies. That is really intoxicating.
I heard a story, I believe it was on Marketplace, the public radio program, where they talked about how pro football as a social event is actually perfectly timed because in a 2 to 3 hour game, you really don't have that much activity. There's a lot of pauses, there's a lot of breaks, and so you have people coming together, and so that can be a part of the enjoyment as well.
Yeah, I mean, people complain about commercials and so forth, but it's really creating this interstitial space, this social space, and I think it's largely for men. Men are most of the fan base and the dedicated fan base, and it's a way, it's the lingua franca of modern man, certainly modern American man, that we have problems saying, hey, Brady, let's go out and get lunch and have a salad and talk about our feelings and so forth. I don't behave that way, and I wish I did, but I'm not that enlightened. I need a sporting event, something that sort of is legitimately male, before I can kind of ease into more intimate discourse with other men.
Now, what was it that caused your feelings on football to start to change?
Well, it's a whole series of things. I mean, years ago, I wrote a book review of this book, The Blind Side, which is this amazing Michael Lewis book in which this young African-American kid is kind of adopted by a rich white family. And it's this inspirational story. They get him into a private high school. He goes off to college, to their alma mater, of course, and makes the pros. And we're supposed to sort of have that underdog feeling that Americans have.
But turned right into a movie, in fact.
That's right, a big movie, Sandra Bullock won an Oscar. We all know about The Blind Side. The way it plays on the screen is this inspirational Horatio Alger story. But there's this unsettling question right in the center of the book where the kid asks this question of his adoptive white mother, he says, you know, would you have rescued me if I was just some African-American kid from, you know, housing development who was just going to wind up flipping burgers at McDonald's? He's really saying, Brady, what is the nature of your interest in me as a human being? And if we're honest, the nature of her interest is in him specifically because he's wildly good at football. He has this physical prowess. She might also be interested eventually in the development of his character, but most fans really aren't. We don't select for football players based on the content of their character. We're not interested, if we're honest with ourselves, about their intellectual or moral development. We want them to entertain us on Saturdays and Sundays, and there is an aspect of that that is exploitation, and especially because most players are African American, 2/3 of the league, and many of them come from economically vulnerable neighborhoods. To me, there was a real feeling of, oh, this is a racially exploitative game. I also felt that there were a number of things that were unsettling about the way that football has infiltrated our educational system, since we now know that it causes diminished brain function in people who play it at all levels. And the third thing that was really the clincher for me is that my mother suffered an acute dementia, and I flew out to California and I walked into the intensive care unit room, and my mom was gone. You know, her function was gone. The thing that makes us who we are is our brains, and when that's gone, our mothers, our fathers, or whoever is suffering with a cognitive breakdown is gone. And so for me, it really connected those two synapses between watching this game that I love that provides me so much pleasure and excitement and the realization that I'm consuming a form of violence that 20 or 30 years down the road is going to result in a Junior Seau or a Dave Durson or a Mike Webster losing their cognitive function, falling into severe depression, being disoriented and frightened, and in the way that my mom was. I think it's really tough for Americans to morally interrogate their pleasures, but when you look at football, and especially as we're looking at it now, and we hear that 1 out of 3 players are going to suffer from long-term cognitive function, that is not something that it lines up with the values of 2014 America. For us to say, it's okay for us to have a form of entertainment that we consume in which 1/3 of the players are going to get brain damage down the road, I don't think that's actually okay with most Americans. And the trick of the NFL, and the NCAA for that matter, is that they're a huge business that's trying to keep us from, you know, from realizing the dark side of the sport. And my book is really just an attempt to say, I love football, it's an amazing game, but I'm heartbroken that it is also so profoundly dangerous, greedy, that it causes us to suppress our empathy in any number of ways.
Now, your book came together before we learned about Ray Rice, before that video came out, before we learned about Adrian Peterson and the indictment against him. But
sure,
domestic violence isn't new to the NFL. Unfortunately, this has been not only an ongoing problem in football, but in society as a whole.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. You know, I hear this is what the sports media does and what fans do. We've got all these excuses that we carry. Oh, well, the players are adults. They get paid lots of money. And, you know, so it's their choice. So we get what my book is saying. Yeah, but you're choosing to watch these guys. And I think what we do in America is we sit in judgment of people like Ray Rice or Adrian Peterson. And in fact, we watch over and over again the most painful moments of their lives. You know, we really consume that form of violence. It's very voyeuristic and it's sickening because those people need support and counseling, and that they need to be held accountable for their actions. They don't need a media scrum and a bunch of voyeurs. What I would say is that if you take a short step back, the problem with the NFL is that it has toxic gender roles. When my 7-year-old daughter, if I were to put her in front of a TV, and the football game was on, what she would see is that women are defined as sexual ornaments who are supposed to jiggle on the sidelines, and men are defined as inherently aggressive figures who are effective in the world by being physically dominant. Those aren't the gender roles of 2014 America. They're not the gender roles of 1950 or 1850 America. They're the gender roles of 1550. That's Guinevere in a halter top and Sir Lancelot in shoulder pads. It is wildly out of sync with the culture that exists around it. And football is this zone. It's almost a morality-free zone where we don't hold it to the same standards on any level that we do the rest of the world.
And is that simply because the relationship culturally with football is so big that it colors the attitudes around these broader societal issues as they pertain to football?
No, I think it's because we really love the game and we want to be able to find a way to watch it, even though we know that deep in our hearts it doesn't line up with our values as citizens, as parents, and so forth. I mean, this is part of the big trick in American culture, is to get people to consume the things that are pleasurable to them, whether it's meat or petroleum or football, and not think about the moral cost down the road. What we're seeing right now, I believe, is a kind of moral crossroads. The country is realizing in a fundamental way, even with the way in which these scandals are trying to be sort of reduced to blaming a scapegoat, it's Roger Goodell's fault, it's Ray Rice's fault, Adrian Peterson's fault, I think there's a fundamental moral reckoning that's happening where people, rather than judging football purely just as a form of entertainment for our pleasure, are starting to recognize that there is a moral cost to be paid for consuming such a profoundly violent game. You can't tell guys like Adrian Peterson or Ray Rice all their lives to lead with their head, to be tough, to be a man, and man is defined as aggressive and suppressing your empathy so that you can do your job as a football player, and expect that the moment they step over the chalk sidelines and they're off the gridiron, they become gentlemen role models. That's just not how human beings operate. We have consumed the violence for years in the NFL, and we continue to sponsor the game. And until individual fans really reckon with that, I don't think we have any right to sit in judgment of these players.
You told my colleague Virginia Prescott on Word of Mouth recently that you would like to see a national conversation about football and issues like concussions, about domestic violence, about child abuse. But it sounds like you're saying we're not yet seeing that.
I think what we're seeing is a media that is trying to chase scandals. To me, the fact that one out of three, the NFL has admitted itself that one out of three players of their own employees are going to wind up with long-term cognitive problems. That is a phenomenal, phenomenal statistic. In what other workplace would we find that even close to acceptable? It is absolute madness that there is a workplace in which, in an overt way, we're saying one out of three guys who play this game are going to suffer long-term cognitive problems. I can't imagine that there's another realm where that is, where we would find that acceptable, whether it was police officers, whatever it would be. But in fact, what we're focused on, or I think what the media is frantically focused on, are these quick scapegoats. It's Ray Rice, it's Roger Goodell, and it's bigger than that.
We're going to have to wrap it up at that because we're heading into a break. Steve Almond, thanks so much for your time today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
That's Steve Almond. His most recent book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. We hope you'll join us as we look at the NFL on The Exchange here on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at the NFL, its culture, its policies, issues from domestic violence to concussions and more. We hope you'll call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. With us for the hour is Stuart Glassman, concussion specialist at Granite Physiatry and member of the New Hampshire Advisory Council on Sport-Related Concussion. He works with New Hampshire schools to test for and prevent concussions in athletics. He has sons who play football at the high school and college level. Stuart Glassman, great to have you.
Glad to be here, Brady.
And joining us by phone is Kavitha Davidson. She's sports reporter for Bloomberg View. Great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll just start with you, Stuart. We're just hearing Steve Almond, who said he's been a lifelong football fan, and as he's been learning more about concussions, which is something that you know plenty about, and some of these other issues that have been coming up in pro football, he said he's completely turned around on it. He cannot reconcile his love of football with these other issues and find a way to still enjoy the game. How have you wrestled with these topics?
Well, I think certainly there's been a question over the last, you know, 5 years at a minimum about the risk of sports, you know, contact sports in general, collision sports, football being one of them. But there certainly has been a more national discussion year by year about the risks of playing sports. There was a White House summit in May of this year where there was a focus on concussion issues. There has recently been $30 million funding between the NCAA and the Department of Defense for concussion research. So there's been more talk about it for sure in the last few years than ever before. But it doesn't take away the fact that if the game involves hitting, there's always going to be the risk of a brain injury.
When you talk with other parents who, and you point out that your sons play football, what kind of response do you get now that might be different from what you got 5 or 10 years ago?
Right. So the question that I'm asked is it worth it? And that was asked of me by a friend of mine. And every parent has to really decide that for themselves. What are the positive parts of being involved with a contact sport, collision sport, football. Teamwork, hard work, working together, that's usually what's pointed out as why it's beneficial. What are some of the, you know, problems with it? Long-term effects, short-term effects. You could have things other than a brain injury occur, obviously, you know, broken legs, you know, knee injuries, spinal cord injuries. And every, you know, child, you know, middle school, high school, may have a different ability to physically withstand some of the, you know, impact and injuries. The answer of is it worth it? It's being asked much more. I think parents are very aware of the risks, but there's not one answer for everyone.
Kavitha, how are fans trying to wrestle with these issues as we start to hear more and more concerns about the physical health of the players, not to mention these issues of domestic violence, child abuse? How does this come up then for fans?
Well, you know, it's really funny because you would think that the concussion issue would be the straw that broke the camel's back. And the fact that that hasn't been the case kind of shows you how powerful the reach of football is, for better or for worse, I guess. You know, you see what's happening with the Ray Rice and the Adrian Peterson domestic violence and now child abuse issues that the NFL is going through. And I get asked constantly, you know, when will fans stop watching the NFL? I think it's a really complicated question. The fact that they didn't with the concussion scandal is very much telling that they're willing to overlook a very inherently dangerous and damaging part of the game. Just the very nature of the game that it's somewhat exploitative and very dangerous to its own players, that shows just kind of how far the reach of football goes. The other part of that is Katie Nolan on Fox Sports noted a really interesting thing the other day when she said the type of people who would stop watching football because of these really important issues are exactly the type of people that we need to keep in the game, essentially, to keep as fans. If they stopped watching, we would lose the critical thinkers that we really need to kind of keep football on its heels and to make sure that the NFL and college football enacts the proper reforms that they need to have. So it's a lot more complicated than just, you know, when will the fans wake up and boycott, or when will the fans wake up and stop supporting the game. It's a really multidimensional issue.
It becomes, Stuart, then a question of, are people willing to be part of that conversation, or are they simply going to say, I'm walking away from this because I feel, as we heard from Steve Almond earlier on, complicit in a way that I'm choosing to watch and therefore choosing in a way to support all of these negative effects that people are concerned about?
Right. I mean, I chose not to watch Monday Night Football last night for the first time in a long time. Why? To see if I could certainly do it, but also because this morning when you wake up, it doesn't change other things going on in the world. It doesn't change ISIS and what they're going to try to do to people. It doesn't change Ebola virus killing people in Africa. So football is a sport, but sport is made of people, and people are human, and they have great qualities about them and also not so great qualities about them. And we have to understand that out of the, you know, 1,800 football players in the NFL roster, you know, the small percentage of them are doing really bad things. The worst probably played for the New England Patriots up until 2 years ago, Aaron Hernandez. You know, and if we haven't learned anything from that, we really have to figure out why do we care about the sport. But ultimately, I think that it comes down to the fact that, you know, no one is better than anyone else in this world. And if you play a sport and get paid to play it and do well, that's great. If you choose to watch it, understand what it is. And if your kids play sports at a young age, as mine have, and you try to teach the right values, then inherently that's not a bad thing. Just remember to have the conversations with your kids when things go bad and you see videos like what Ray Rice did to his fiance at that time, and understand, you know, there are many people who aren't football players who do that all the time. You know, maybe the one thing that's come out of this is that we're talking about a real big issue in a way that maybe if a sports figure wasn't caught on tape, we wouldn't be talking about it to this level now.
Here's an email we got from Rob, who writes, why do we hold the NFL, a form of entertainment, to a different standard than other forms of entertainment? Hollywood is full of morally bankrupt, quote, stars who act badly all the time. We see it on the news, but for some reason it is laughed at and often leads to a boost in their popularity. This media vendetta against the NFL seems very disingenuous to me when we have had countless examples in other forms of entertainment which are ignored. Maybe we can use Hollywood as our starting point for fixing the bad behavior in this country. Rob, thanks so much for that email. Kavitha, what do you make of the way that this has been playing out in the NFL? Is this being treated differently in the most popular sport in the country than it might be in another field?
Well, I think it absolutely is, and I don't think that there's necessarily anything wrong with that, frankly. The NFL is a $9 billion industry and enjoys, 50% of the country watches the Super Bowl. So it enjoys an incredible reach, and that's just the reality of it. The NFL has an influence that we've given it, and whether it's undue or not, that's just the reality. I think the nature of sports is that it's modern day mythology in a way. We look at athletes as heroes because they're able to do things as humans that seem to defy human limitation, human physical limitation. At the same time, what we're seeing with fans defending people like Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson is that. And even in like more benign circumstances with what we're seeing right now with, the coming to the end of Derek Jeter's career, at the same time of this kind of mythology of this hero worship or deification, if you will, there's an element to the understanding that these people are human and that somehow we can know them on a personal level, that somehow these athletes are our friends or are people that we know in a very intimate way because we've seen them do these things. And there's a very inherent contradiction to those two things, to the idea that these people are heroes because they defy human limitation, but that human limitation doesn't apply to their behavior. So I think that there is a very subconscious dilemma that causes this to be considered in a higher state than if it were a musician or an actor, for example.
And is that changing now? The feeling about what goes on the field is what we worry about and what we concern ourselves with versus what goes on off the field. USA Today did some research recently and said there were 14 players active in the NFL right now who have either a history of domestic violence or have been accused of it. And you don't hear about those cases the way that we've heard about Ray Rice.
Well, the reality of it, unfortunately, is that you're not going to hear about those cases, or you're not really going to care about those cases if it's not a star player. The most interesting part about the Adrian Peterson, well, not the most interesting part about the Adrian Peterson case, but the one of the more compelling parts of that is that what will the league do when it's essentially the face of your sport, when it's the guy who is the dominant driver in a multi-million dollar fantasy football industry, when it's probably the best running back that we've seen in a decade, and we saw after I've been saying this for a couple of days now, you can probably thank the New England Patriots defense for the fact that Adrian Peterson is going to suit up this Sunday, because the Vikings kind of saw that they can't really stand to do what's right and to play another Sunday without him. It's a really mixed bag. At the same time, while people will start to view these things differently and will start to be able to kind of compartmentalize what happens on the field versus the way that they view these people as humans and as men as in their everyday lives, you will always still get fans who are defending them because they think that they know them, because they think that that they know that these men are good and have done really great things for their community. And frankly, this is a line that the NFL and that the individual teams are touting right now. They're trying to bank on that kind of sentiment. When the news of Ray Rice first came down, the Ravens released a statement saying, we support the two-game suspension because, everyone makes a mistake and we know the type of guy Ray is and he's done so much for Baltimore and for the local community and we know that he regrets his actions. And the exact same thing happened with the general manager of the Vikings when they decided to reinstate Adrian Peterson yesterday. They said essentially the very same language. We know Adrian. He's a good guy. He's done a lot for the community, and this is a line that fans have really been eating up at a successful rate for the NFL.
Stuart, there was a quote from Tom Brady, quarterback for the New England Patriots, who was asked his reaction to Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson, and he said, quote, "I try to stay in my lane." And he went on to say, "The things that are taking place on other teams or league-wide decisions, those are a different pay grade than me." That idea of compartmentalizing, it goes back a long way, but it sounds like a lot of fans and even some players are starting to question whether they can do that any further, that the more that we learn about some of these issues in the criminal courts and we learn more about concussions, that we do have to have eyes wide open.
Right. If the athletes you worship are just human and make mistakes, well, then they're not superheroes anymore. And it comes at a price, obviously. Unfortunately, a lot of professional athletes, maybe going back to Michael Jordan when he said Republicans buy sneakers also, stay out of social issues until they are forced to not stay out of it. And I think you saw a lot of emotion, this past weekend by commentators because they finally got to talk about something that's been there under the surface for a long time. So I think that ultimately, the decision of what does a sport mean, what do those role models, what do they mean to your kids? It's ultimately what, as a parent, you inform your children about what they're seeing. Because, again, what's on the field is their job. But who they are as a person, that's everything else. And if you're going to have a superhero, understand the good and the bad because, we may end up being like them one day if we don't learn from that.
Let's bring in one of our callers now. The exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Linda is calling from Concord. Hi, Linda. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Brady. I just wanted to mention that it's very important that through these discussions of what's happening in the NFL that we remember that domestic violence is happening to women every single day, every single hour of the day, and that just because the NFL is addressing it now does not mean that it should not be addressed on a global level. And we also do have to realize that even though these guys are trained to be violent and aggressive on the field, that we can't that we do have the right to expect them to be able to act accordingly as good husbands and fathers when they're off the field, that they still have a moral compass to hold for their families, and that the way that they act as a football player should not have to fall across the line into their family lives. So it's great that the NFL is doing something about wanting to address these issues. However, we want to be able to realize that, yes, these may be heroes and mythological creatures to the rest of the world, but we also know that this is happening every single day in a lot of people's lives, and we can't forget that just because the conversation is happening with the NFL.
That's a big set of issues right there. Thank you so much, Linda. I'll ask you, Kavitha, because there's two elements to that. One is that the NFL has started to announce a new initiative trying to prevent domestic violence by players, and there's a panel of individuals who are going to oversee that. But as Linda points out, this is not just about the NFL and domestic violence, that a number of commentators have pointed out that this is a national problem and that we're seeing it through the lens of the NFL because that's where our attention, where it's drawn our attention at the moment.
Well, exactly. And the really unfortunate part of this, well, one of the really unfortunate parts of this issue is that it took a video for us to start paying attention to this. We already had a police report. We already had a first video. We already knew what Ray Rice did to his then fiance, and it took us seeing the actual point of impact for us to care at the level that we're caring right now. And your caller was absolutely right. I take particular issue when senators or congressmen or any kind of politician writes to Roger Goodell or starts to kind of bank on this issue for what seems like purely political gain, because we have to kind of remember that at the same time that people are condemning the NFL's actions as far as domestic violence, we have entire blocks of mostly, frankly, Republican congressmen who voted against the expansion of the Violence Against Women Act. We have, you know, basically the entire GOP voting against the Affordable Care Act, which provides provisions for mental health services and domestic violence services for women and children who are victims of abuse. We have to remember that this is absolutely a national and global issue. And the NFL actually has a lower rate, a lower instance of domestic violence than the general population. The problem with that is that the NFL also has a lower rate of conviction, of penalty, and of punishment when it comes to that. I believe the once a domestic violence issue goes to trial in the United States, the overall conviction rate hovers around 50%, which isn't great for the criminal justice system, and that is absolutely a conversation that we need to be having. But at the same time, Roger Goodell has overseen 56 domestic violence cases in his tenure as commissioner of the NFL, and that has resulted in 13 total games of suspension. So there's absolutely a national problem, a global problem with domestic violence that completely outpaces the problem that we're seeing in the NFL, that might make it seem like the NFL's problem pales in comparison. And it really does when you look at it in relative terms. But at the same time, we should expect better from an institution that generates as much money and that, frankly, commands as much respect as the NFL does.
Here's an email we got from Catherine, who says, I completely agree with your guests, speaking about Steve Almond earlier, that the problem is toxic gender roles. It isn't exclusive to the NFL, but the NFL culture certainly takes it to the extreme. And Stuart, I want to pick up with that with you after a short break. But first, I want to say thank you so much, Kavitha Davidson, for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kavitha Davidson, sports reporter for Bloomberg View. When we come back after a short break, more discussion of the issues surrounding the National Football League. We hope you'll join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at the NFL, issues around domestic violence, child abuse, and concussions, and what they mean for the league going forward. Join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Joining me in the studio this hour is Stuart Glassman, concussion specialist at Granite Physiatry and member of the New Hampshire Advisory Council on Sport-Related Concussion. He works with New Hampshire schools to test for and prevent concussions in athletics. He has sons who play football at high school and college levels. We were talking just before the break with Kavitha Davidson of Bloomberg View, Stuart, and she was talking about some of the issues that go into domestic violence issues in pro football and how the league has or hasn't handled it. And I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on that as well.
Sure. So just some education for our listeners who may not realize this. So in 1968, when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he was a senator from New York State. Governor Rockefeller appointed Roger Goodell's father, Charles Goodell, to take over his seat because Charles Goodell was a representative in Congress. And Charles Goodell was a U.S. senator for 2 years. He lost his reelection bid because he opposed the Vietnam War. Roger Goodell was probably about 10 or 11 years old at this time. So if you think back at that time, the Nixon administration really was the reason why there was no reelection for Roger Goodell's father.
They made a point of running against him.
Correct. He was a Republican, and he stood up for what appeared to be a liberal view. And Spiro Agnew and the White House decided that that was not someone that they wanted on their side of the field, no pun intended. So maybe at that age, Roger Goodell learned if you stand up for certain things that are morally right, you may pay the price. I don't know how that has impacted his career, but at this point, certainly, there are a lot of issues that the NFL has been facing. And one of the questions to think about is, in any other career, if you were in a position of leadership and you were charged with a felony or arrested, you would probably lose your job because it would probably be in your contract that if that happened, you would be let go before a trial occurred, innocent until proven guilty. Clearly, in the National Football League, that is not the case because we've seen so many different outcomes for all of these violent issues that have come up with all these players over the last few years. And the real question that has to be asked is, why is it that way? If the goal of the owners of the National Football League teams and Roger Goodell is to protect the brand, then you would think if a player risked the brand, you couldn't tolerate that. But we're almost seeing the opposite, which is the brand can never be questioned, and that includes never questioning those that suit up on the field. Maybe in New England we're insulated from that because that's not how the Patriots work. No one is above being let go, no matter how much money you make. I guess Tom Brady is probably the only exception, potentially. But they don't accept anything but, you know, performance and moral performance, too. So maybe we're in a different culture here in New England because we've seen, you know, the expectations of smart players who don't, you know, play for anything but the team. But I think the National Football League and people who watch it, you know, clearly have to weigh out, you know, the decision going forward as to what does it all mean for you.
Let's hear from another one of our listeners. Cheryl is calling from Hudson. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Interesting conversation, and I just want to put a little bit into it, which is I don't understand. First off, people who commit crimes should be prosecuted, and like you said, they should lose their job. But another point to me is that when do we as a public start taking responsibility for what is happening? Because without our support, they cannot continue to be this powerful group that they are. In other words, you know, there's a doctor out there this morning performing surgery, and there was one last week that performed it, or a few months ago on my son, that saved his arm. Saved his arm. He's not making $1 million a year. Now, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. We treat them like gods. We pay them these outrageous salaries, and then we expect them not to be pompous and act the way they do. You know, we as fans support it. So we should start taking a good look at ourselves.
Thank you, Cheryl, so much for those comments. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And that's another one of the questions that keeps coming up, Stuart, in the course of this conversation is it's not simply enough, I guess, anymore to say, well, I like football and my job as a fan is just to watch. And it's not necessarily I don't have a role in shaping the problem or the solution. And increasingly, there are fans who are saying that's not the case.
Oh, I think that anyone that does participate in watching, buying tickets, buying jerseys, you know, wearing someone's jersey, you are part of the process. And I think that at the end of the day, the National Football League and the owners of the teams know that if fans start to turn away, they have a big problem, which is why things have changed, but they've changed probably from a calculated perspective to some degree. The NFL Players Association does not really like the owners or the commissioner because of how things are often handled. The concussion awareness has gotten better. There's no doubt about that. But there are other issues that, you know, we probably don't talk about very much where there is definitely a divide between the players, the owners, and ultimately, the fans, the public, the advertisers help keep it going. If you feel there's a problem, just like 14 female U.S. senators wrote to Roger Goodell and said there is a problem with domestic violence and you need to deal with this, then any one voice can start the discussion and swell to thousands making their opinions heard.
Well, thank you again, Cheryl, for that call. Joining us now is Michael McCann, a professor at UNH School of Law and director of UNH's Sports and Entertainment Law Institute. He's also a legal analyst and writer for Sports Illustrated. Michael McCann, great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's take a look at some of these legal considerations now, and we'll just start with where the situation stands right now in the Ray Rice case, because we've been talking about the sanctions and punishment, but really you're talking about both what the NFL is doing, what his team is doing, and then the actual criminal legal process.
Yeah, so right now Ray Rice, as we know, he was essentially pleaded guilty and received a probationary program where he would receive counseling in lieu of a prison sentence, which was an unusual and some would say charitable sentence for Ray Rice, given what we've seen. In fact, it's rare. Apparently, there's been some research on it for someone in New Jersey to receive, to not go to trial after committing a violent offense, although he was a first-time offender, so there are some counterfacts. But in terms of the criminal justice system, he's done. He can't be retried, even despite these videos. There's double jeopardy. under the Constitution where you can't try somebody twice, but he won't be tried again. In terms of his NFL status, the Ravens released him. He was also suspended 2 games over the summer by the NFL, and the NFL then gave him a new suspension following the public revelation of the elevator video where he punches his then-fiancée, now-wife, Danae Rice. Although he has argued that the NFL already knew about that, in fact, that the NFL had the tape, that it shouldn't justify a new penalty. So he's going to challenge that and argue that it's uncalled for.
Through that there's an appeals process for players in situations where there's disciplinary action taken. Here's a question we got by email from Nick. He says, why is it the responsibility of the NFL to punish in such cases? Doesn't society have that responsibility through the courts?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, right? The court system does have a duty to prosecute crimes against the state. And in this context, that happened. He was prosecuted, although I think the outcome was underwhelming. And then secondly, the employer of anyone who's prosecuted has a right to relieve itself of that person because of the bad will that's caused, because maybe the person's even a safety risk. So I think both ends can be achieved, and I think that was the goal here, although I think the criminal justice system treated Ray Rice very favorably. And in terms of the NFL, I think the initial 2-game suspension was seen by most as inadequate. And now this new suspension, the indefinite suspension, is seen by many as not clear in terms of what part of the collective bargaining agreement is being used to justify it, and that's going to be Ray Rice's argument.
Is there a concern in the NFL or in any situation like this where a league might say, look, somewhere down the road, someone might decide that we're liable for the way that this player has been behaving and the actions that go on. We need to do something proactively to deal with it. Is there any legal consideration, not to mention the PR potential implications?
Well, it would be hard to hold an NFL team or the league tortiously liable for the acts of a player off the field. Under the law, it's called vicarious liability, where an employer is held responsible for the acts of an employee. But it's very difficult to hold an employer liable when an employee is acting outside the scope of his employment. And in this context, Ray Rice was in a casino hotel, clearly outside the scope of his employment. And just to extend that point, Aaron Hernandez, if the charges against him are true, was clearly acting outside the scope of his employment as a New England Patriot when he allegedly murdered now 3 individuals. So I think the legal consequences are light in that regard. There's always an argument that maybe a player on the field is posing a danger, but we haven't really seen those lawsuits. So I think this is more of a PR issue for the NFL, and from the standpoint of the commissioner, an issue where, as we talked about earlier, the show steward with your guest, the commissioner is under fire for what many see as inadequate responses.
Here's an email we got from Paul who says, I hope that you don't lose sight of the long-term effects that TBI, traumatic brain injury, has on behavior. We are creating men who become violent towards women and others as a result of their participation in this game. Please don't make this all about players making moral choices when the battering their brains undergo significantly affects their ability to think. This is essentially speculation at this point for me to ask, but is there a concern that, you know, someone might try to make that argument that this charge of domestic violence against me is a direct result of my football playing, and therefore then there is a legal issue that comes up?
Yeah, I think that would be a stretch in terms of causation. I think many would argue that while I'm sure there's a medical link between the behavior of players and any data which suggests that they're more violent and potential brain injury. I think the reality is that a court would struggle to find that to be sufficient causation. And I would add, I know that there are clearly a handful of players that have gotten into some terrible trouble. The vast majority of NFL players are not, from what we can tell, out of control, right? The most seem to be law-abiding. In fact, if you look at the data of NFL players versus men aged 21 to 30, I don't know if there's going to be a huge divide between the propensity of being charged with crime among NFL players and men in that age group. Not to say it's not a concern. I'm not by any means saying that. But I don't know if the data is as alarming as some of these individual instances.
And that's something that Kavitha Davidson was talking about earlier, the reporter from Bloomberg View. She said that compared to broader society, Stuart, that that we don't necessarily see at the same rates. But I did want to ask you, since concussions is what you study, what have we learned thus far about the effect of repeated brain injuries as sometimes players receive over the course of a career, and how that does affect their behavior, much less their physical health?
Right. Well, certainly that brings in the question of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, which has really been a lot of the focus in research in the last 5 years, and why this settlement occurred with the National Football League last year, that repeated hits to the head can lead to earlier development of this problem. It's typically found only at the time of autopsy, although there are markers being looked at this point to try to identify it earlier on.
CTE is something you can't spot until
right.
A player has already died.
There are some biological markers that are being researched now to possibly spot it prior to having an autopsy. But I think certainly players that get to that level in the National Football League or even college have been able to withstand some of those hits much more than others that played in youth football and middle school and high school football. But certainly the brain changes can lead to emotional changes without a doubt. So while there's no direct causation at this point, the concern is that, as an adult, you're choosing to participate and be paid to play a sport that may be bad for your health. And certainly, I think the research is showing that those changes even happen in people where there was no diagnosis of a concussion.
Let's hear from one more of our listeners. Christina is calling from Fremont. Hi, Christina. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, thank you. I think that a part that we may be missing, and I'm not at all saying that I agree with what the NFL is doing, but, we're forgetting about the fact that they're inheriting some part of an epidemic that starts in the college age, where athletes are able to get away with domestic violence quite frequently. I mean, I witnessed it myself when I was in college. So although I feel like they should be taking more preemptive steps, kind of like you just suggested a little while ago, is, possibly helping these athletes out before their domestic violence behavior increases and gets worse, they are still inheriting, a good amount of athletes because colleges don't take the proper steps to support those violence tendencies.
That's a good question, Christina, and I'll just turn it to you, Michael McCann. What do you make of that question?
I think Christina is right that the issue of domestic violence on college campuses is a major concern. And I think that goes well beyond football, well beyond sports. I think it's an issue that I know that the White House has emphasized in recent months in terms of better enforcing Title IX, which is a law that's most often regarded as a law that's to promote gender equity in sports, but actually is much more expansive than that. And it also compels schools to give due process to alleged victims of domestic violence, and there's concern in the White House and in the Department of Education that many victims are not given that. And I think in the Jameis Winston story, the Florida State football player who was accused of rape, there are concerns about how Florida State responded to a situation like that. Now, he was a football player, but I think the point is it can be extended beyond just sports, that issues of domestic violence on college campuses has to be given more attention. And also there have to be ways of victims of feeling as if that they're not going to be stigmatized. I mean, this is a concern, right? When you accuse a star football player, you become the target of animosity. And I don't know how to fix that. I don't think there is an easy fix given the prevalence of sports, but it's something that certainly warrants more attention.
As we wrap up the hour, Stuart Glassman, what we just heard Michael say applies to a lot of the issues we've talked about. I don't know that there's an easy fix for some of the topics that we've discussed going forward. What are the questions we need to at least ask quickly?
Right. The questions to ask are, if there's a silver lining in this whole issue, it's can parents teach their kids at a young age how to act the right way, what to do, what not to do, and as parents to also act the right way towards your kids as well. Because if you preach it but you don't do it, the message is going to be diluted for sure.
And Michael McCann, quickly, what questions are you going to be looking at as this conversation continues, as no doubt it will?
Well, I think just from the standpoint of the NFL, I think the league and the Players Association have to take a more collaborative spirit in trying to address issues of domestic violence. And I think both of your guests mentioned earlier that it extends beyond just the NFL, that this goes down to the beginning of playing sports, where aggression is learned, and further studying the connection between that type of behavior and domestic violence, but just criminal acts in general, I think, is something that certainly needs to be more explored.
Well, Michael McCann and Stuart Glassman, thanks both for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer today is Ross Boyd. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy.